Welcome to Edge of Sports, the podcast. I'm Dave Zirin, joined again this week by Arya Shirazi as we talk about basketball that's interesting to us, particularly sometimes with a nostalgic glimpse towards yesteryear. Okay, here's the topic for this week's show. Check this out. The average number of points scored in an NBA game is right now the highest it's been in 55 years. The average number of points per game is 115.6, and that's the highest since the 1979-1970 season. Average points per game have been steadily increasing for about 15 years, and this trend is almost certain to continue. Now, there are a few basic reasons for this, which we could discuss, I mean, that are just factual, like there are more possessions now because teams operate at a faster pace. There's the three-point culture of pace and space, and they're better players from a global talent pool running a pace and space operation where there are multiple ace shooters on the court at one time. And there are other reasons that people debate until they are blue in the face. But that's not what Arya and I are really interested in this conversation. Arya and I are talking about something much more primal. The game is different. Yes, it certainly is. But do we like this version of the league? Do we like this version of the game we love? And is it even that binary? Do we like 70% of the new but don't like 30%? You know, whatever it might be, but we're gonna try to quantify it a little bit. But what really it comes down to quite simply is, do we like it now better or worse? Arya Shirazi, how are you, sir?
Never better, my friend.
So, first thoughts, just based on the intro in and the topic du jour.
Looking forward to talking about the state of the game today. As you say, we usually focus on yesteryear, how yester depends on the topic. But we've been reliving a lot of different eras in the NBA. So I'm definitely looking forward to focusing on the state of the game and the state of the league as it stands currently, and will reserve judgment on how I truly feel about it or where I place it in the context of eras that came before it until the end of our conversation.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest difference, and you know, we're talking through better or worse. The biggest difference to me isn't some of the factual stuff I said, like more possessions or the Euro talent pool. You know, the biggest difference for me is something that you mentioned on a previous broadcast, and that's positionality. Like, I was raised so resolutely, almost, you know, Catholic, like my catechism was, big man is center, burly man who will punch you in the face is power forward, slick shooter off the wing and in the paint, that's your small forward. The guy who bombs from outside, and bombs back then wasn't even really a three-pointer, that's your shooting guard, and then the floor general, the point guard. And those, with exceptions, but not huge exceptions, that era of the game is just done. I mean, we're post-positionality. They even changed the All-NBA team this year that there won't be a center position, just three forwards and two guards. And, you know, that's created a different kind of game. And there's certainly aspects of that I miss, like the majesty of the man in the middle. And the floor general archetype, I mean, that's like really attractive to me, you know, growing up, like in terms of like people that you could imagine yourself playing like when you were on the court or something like that. So that's just a couple of cents from me on this. Like one of the big differences for me really is positionality and the loss of the kind of aura that each position would bring to the table.
Yeah, I mean, we have talked about, familiarity is comforting. And the NBA that is familiar to us and people of our generation who grew up watching the NBA when we did, there's always going to be a sense of nostalgia, but also we have dissected in various threads. The game was really wonderful at that point. And again, you've talked about the big man and the importance of the big man and the steadiness of knowing what a center was supposed to do. The league of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Moses Malone, where having that anchor in the middle and the other four positions playing off of that central big man in the middle by the hoop is what ultimately won championships and would also seem to be winning MVPs. Out of that spawned Magic and Michael, who not only became the league's dominant player, and not only were do players and were doing it from the backcourt as opposed to the front court, but did it with a style of play that truly revolutionized the game. Not only were those guys the most fun and magical players to watch pretty much ever, but they were also winning the championships and the MVPs. So the game then shifted with that as the prototype. And so, we've also talked about the idea of positionless basketball and that kind of breakdown of what we knew as the traditional positions and how we feel about that, and I'm very conflicted, really, in my feelings about today's NBA versus the stages of the NBA of the last 3 or 4 decades that came before this.
I mean, yeah. Well, just a couple of things. One is my son lately has taken to trolling me by showing me 90, and there's a lot of this on YouTube, 90s basketball highlights. And yeah, it's tough to watch. Like, there's some embarrassing stuff in 90s basketball compared to today in terms of things like, just a total absence of defensive rotations, total absence of any movement, with exceptions, of course, but not a lot of movement without the ball. I mean, the mental side of today's game, I feel like I see it so much more clearly, and I feel like the sophistication of coaching and schemes, is a lot more than, throw it down to Kareem and wait for that sky hook. I mean, some of those, or bunching up particularly, like the absence of space really does shine out to me when Jacob shows me those videos. And sometimes it's like, I'm like, okay, well, the sport's evolved, and I'm sort of left there, because the aesthetic of today's game is beautiful. But then at the same time, like, remember, like, a center would go to a club and the club's record would like flip, like a David Robinson or an Akeem. Certainly Kareem is in this category, but like, the great centers would show up and then your whole world would change. And that, you just don't have that anymore.
Then again, the kind of the hottest young player in the league is Victor Wembanyama. So, he obviously is like a 7'4", 20-year-old who is the extreme product of his generation. But I think that that's still height It's like a player with an all-around game at 6'6 is not as prized as that same player with that same game who's 6'9. So height is still, even if it's utilized differently and not utilized in the way that is so familiar and comforting to us, I think that height and prospects who are tall still have an allure, and there's a tantalizing aspect to them that's different from even elite prospects at the forward or guard position. So height still in that, it still is basketball. So height still does carry, is still the most prized, what you can get out of that height. But of course, I mean, you're absolutely right, talking about the shift of the game. When you're talking, when you were talking earlier about the average points per game, now well into the hundreds. If you're a fan of basketball, you don't want to see missed shots. You don't watch ball to watch missed shots. So scoring in itself is why you play the game. And clearly, I mean, the most obvious and maybe lazy, but also truthful reason that scores have elevated is the dominance of the three-point shot. It's why individual scoring numbers are up and team scoring numbers are up, because you're putting three, 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 three on the board all game. So that's why it's going to raise. You were talking about the 90s and how the 90s now aesthetically does not stand up as favorably to the game of today. And I am sometimes surprised when I see a score from the 90s score in a finals game or a playoff game, and it's in the low 80s or even the high 70s, and I'm like, oh, that's really low. That's an early third quarter score now. But it didn't seem that way at the time. It didn't seem that way. I don't feel as though we were watching ball at that time and grimacing or saying, man, these are ugly games, or these guys just can't score. You talked about how the game has evolved now. The game was always evolving as life evolves, or if not evolving, just changing. The game of George Mikan and Bob Pettit into the game of Oscar Robertson.
Yeah.
Into Kareem, into Magic and Michael, into Kobe and LeBron, and here we are now. So it is an evolution, but also just because years go on, time passes, and things change. You know, you look, I feel as though the kind of state of the game before this, first decade of this century, was really kind of ISO ball. And, you know, and scores were lower, but those really, the league that Kobe inherited and kind of the Kobe, Allen Iverson, Tracy McGrady model, as far as guys winning scoring titles, who are those guys, then followed up by Carmelo, LeBron, and Durant, it was that that sense of put the ball in the hands of your best player and may the best player win, which ultimately was why the Lakers had a bunch of rings at that time. But really, there were a lot of pounding, 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 putting up an off-balance long two as the shot clock was winding down. And the best players were hitting a lot more of those really hard shots than they had any right to, because they were the best scorers in the world. Nowitzki, another great bad shot maker, bailing out his team with uninspired possessions by putting up points on the board just because he's a good scorer. But that style of ball was rightly criticized. And one thing I will say in favor of today's game, and I have plenty to say about it that I don't absolutely love, but one thing along with the scoring numbers that I think is very heartening is the high percentage of assists on made field goals. The most obvious trend to identify is how many of those field goals and attempts are threes. But as I said, the majority now of made field goals per team are assisted, which attests to ball movement and attests to high-powered offenses are played with rapid ball movement. And everybody can pretty much shoot now. That means the ball is moving, because in general, coaches and teammates feel comfortable about whoever the ball is swung to get the most open shot they can. So ball movement and shot distribution is good. I'm in favor of that. ISO ball that we were talking about, and at the time, I've always loved the NBA. So I was as into the NBA when that was the dominant style of play as I am now. But not only were the games much lower scoring, the assist percentages were much less, because as we were just saying, it was the dominant scorer or dominant scorers really pounding and trying to make a play for themselves. I do prefer the idea of moving the ball around, getting good shots, and a lot of skilled players being able to put up a lot of shots. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we're wrestling with is the paradoxical nature of the three-point shot, because we want more points, and that means smart teams shoot a ton of three-pointers. Three is bigger than two. But at the same time, you know, a great three-point shooter is going to hit 40% of their threes. So you're only going to see 40% of those go in. Now, if you're a coach, you don't care about that, because that's like hitting 60% of your twos, which would be insane. So you're thrilled with 40% from three, but it does mean a lot of clanging and banging from outside sometimes. That can be rough on the eyes. So it's a mix of things. I love that everybody touches the ball a lot more. I love that pick and roll combos have to be like really slick passers. It's not like the old days where, you know, Karl Malone would end up with an open 15-footer on every single damn pick and roll. It's like there's better defense and there's slicker offense. I think Nikola Jokic is such a unicorn and so fun to watch. I mean, that a player like that even exists is wild to me. So that leaves me in an odd place, because sometimes I wish there was no three-point line and it had to be strategized a lot differently. And would people still play with space? Because the thing about spacing is that it does lead to more ball movement and it leads to more layups. You know, the whole concept of the dunker's spot did not exist when we were coming up, and now it's regular parlance, Aaron Gordon in the dunker's spot. So I don't know. I'm curious what your thoughts are on the barrage of three-pointers being a part of any team, and the teams that aren't doing the three-pointers are criticized, and, you know, they tend to be the worst teams. So what do we say about that?
I think you made two perfect segues in your last point, and I'll try to I'll try to remember them both. The introduction of analytics obviously changed the way offense and defense was approached and became a very polarizing reality among fans. Even as you were describing the very basic mathematical mindset behind the three-point revolution, it reminded me of why I've never been interested in the analytics side. It's the kind of on-floor thinking that's not romantic to me, that's not taking away the spontaneity of every single possession and every possession being the result of all the possessions that came before it, both offensively and defensively, and what worked and what didn't. If you are so aware that, hey, it's better to shoot 41% from three than it is 47% from two, and basic numbers crunching supports that, that might be true, but I don't care about that. That's not sports to me. That's not athletics to me in the way that I like to play it and the way that I like to watch it or think about it. So that sense of being so aware of, you know, having your feet behind the three-point line unless you're going to get a dunk or a layup, that's what makes me, you know, miss the days of Karl Malone getting open 15-footers. But you mentioned Jokic, and I have, and in a way, of course, Jokic exists the way he does. Jokic has to exist. Now, he is the most extreme version of the, or result of the progression of basketball. You had talked about evolution. Evolution is inevitable. And so this is the result of that. The result of the way the game has changed. And that the game is now being played in all corners of the world. Of course, Jokic is, you know, there had to be a Jokic. And it's not totally surprising that he's from Serbia. But
go ahead.
No, but, you know, but he had to be from somewhere. And I know what you're saying, but it's... I'm not trying to be cheeky, but it's no, I mean, of course, it's the progression and the alterations of the game over a multi-decade span results in players at the very top of the league like Jokic. The last 5-10 years when I've had versions of this discussion, my overriding feeling is usually kind of a variation of, I don't necessarily love the game the way it's played now so crazy much, but the league is populated with absolutely beyond unbelievable players, is populated with the most skilled players of all time. And then that asks the question of why are they the most skilled? And it's because because of the time that they are learning the game into becoming professionals. Would Hakeem Olajuwon have been a great three-point shooter? He was kind of great at everything he did. He never had to shoot threes because he was a big man. So we'll never know if Hakeem would have been a great three-point shooter. He was the best at the way the game was played in his time. You flash forward to now, and as we've both been saying, the players who are driving winning teams and playing for championships and playing for the top awards, there are 10 to 15 individual players who are, their skills are not to be believed, and they perform on a nightly basis. I feel as though Jokic and Doncic, even among this crop, those two guys are revolutionary players.
Yeah.
And it makes sense to me that one is 7 feet and one is shorter, is a guard, a big guard, but definitely a point guard's mentality. Yeah. But I think in the last, over the last year, those two guys have really extra stood out to me as players who truly have never existed before. And I think because of them, the next two decades will be defined by those two, how they played, and ultimately the winning that came along with that. In Jokic's case, it's already happened and he's looking to build on it. It remains to be seen how much winning Doncic can add to his individual career. But I have to say that I feel as though those two guys at this point are the best two players that I've ever seen.
Well,
and
I have to throw Wembanyama in that too. I mean, as far as like somebody who is doing things, I mean, a guy 7'4" doing, you know, step back three pointers is just bonkers. And his ability to cover ground is crazy. I think he's going to, I don't think you could even put a ceiling on what Wembanyama could be. We'll find, it's going to be fun to find out too. This is an interesting discussion. Like I'm with you in the the negative shout out to Gilbert Arenas talking about how European players aren't physical, like it's 2002, and he's on Fox News, and you just mentioned two players, Jokic and Doncic, his physicality defines so much of their game. It's just Zubats should bonk Gilbert Arenas on the head. It just a little absurdity there. Shout out to the finest Washington Wizard since Elvin Hayes. Jesus Christ, what a sad franchise. It's not cut and dried. Like, I think I enjoy what I enjoyed back then. I mean, obviously, it wasn't like soccer, but because your NBA Finals game could be 82-79, the baskets really meant something. Yeah, it was tough to get a hoop. And if you got a hoop, it was like, yes. You know, it was a big deal. I mean, obviously not like a soccer goal where there's like three and you lose your mind, but definitely more than today where it's like, oh, threw in another three. You know, it's like these days it just feels like it takes more to up my blood pressure, you know, than it used to. And and frankly, like it takes watching somebody like Kyrie, like one of the great wizards with the ball, for me to like feel something deep when back in the day, and this isn't just about getting older at all to me, it's about the personalities. I mean, there's so many great personalities in the game, but having the game match their personality, that's only given to a few players, like Luka, for example, where they get to show their personality through their game. You know, there's just a lot of Jaden McDaniels out there who are insanely skilled, but you know, the Jaden McDaniels move is not something kids are doing on the courtyard.
No, I mean, we've in our last discussion when we relived players from the 80s who were really important players at that time and aren't remembered as much as we feel as though they should be. I talked in regards to a few different players about the NBA being a 2-point game, being played within the 3-point line, being played often within the paint, and the players who were excelling at that game. We've talked about not only the big men, but great scorers like Bernard King and Adrian Dantley and Mark Aguirre, who battled much bigger guys nightly to score inside and get to the line. And you know, you had just talked about it, almost a football mentality. The idea of getting 2 points in crunch time, almost like, getting the ball over the goal line for a touchdown, or conversely, getting a goal line stand. Getting a big stop over 24 seconds. And even if the basic mentality is the same, the way in which occurs is different because the game has up and extended so much. So I certainly miss that degree of how can you get 2 points going in to get 2 points? You had talked last time about Jeff Malone and about the great 2-point jump shooter and coming off screen jump shooter that Jeff was, and about how, apparently he just didn't have 3-point range. Fantastic 18-foot shooter, but just didn't extend to the 3-point line. It didn't need to for Jeff. I'm sure that if it had been emphasized, I think that Jeff with that touch could have m moved his range back a few feet and become a 3-point shooter. But he never had to do that. Just keep doing what you're doing. Many players like Jeff, he's just the one that we talked about recently. But Showtime basketball winning championships, going into the triangle winning championships, going into the not duplicated inside outside combination of Shaquille and Kobe winning championships, going into the ISO era. We had just talked about the ISO era and how it does not aesthetically stand up now as far as pleasing basketball eras. Coming out of ISO ball is the Warriors. Steve Nash and D'Antoni had tried to buck it with Phoenix, but they were never able to win the title. So ultimately, they weren't the model to follow. The Warriors became the model to follow. In their run of dominance, the way they played the game, they really, I think, are the forefathers of the way the game is played today. And of course, Curry is still at it. And on any given night, Curry is still the best at it. So that is ongoing. But really, it is that. It is the Warriors winning championships that ushers in the prevalent style of play. And even kind of thinking about the state of the game, in addition to the numerous incredible individual talents spread throughout the league is as open as it's been. In the not too recent past, it was pretty clear that the Warriors were going to come out of the West. Mm-hmm. And they're probably going to win the championship. I'm glad that's not where we're at now. This league, both conferences, are completely wide open. If the Celtics and Nuggets are the favorites, that makes sense, but they're by no means shoo-ins to come out of their respective conferences. Both of those teams have some glaring holes, as do the other contenders. And there's a lot of contenders, which is supported by how tight the standings are in both conferences. And that's a good thing. I love a league where a lot of teams feel like they can compete at the highest level, or a lot of teams are looking to enter the postseason feeling as though we're the team that's coming together at the right time, and we're the ones who are going to make a run. I love that. The more teams eyeing a championship, the more competitive the league is. And we all want the maximum competition. So in many ways, when breaking it down, I'd have to say the NBA is in good shape in many important fundamental ways. The players at the top of it, who are winning individual awards and record-shattering numbers, are also, by and large, the leaders of winning teams, mm-hmm. looking to take their teams deep into the playoffs. Jokic has already won a title, looking to defend, and has good a chance of winning it again as just about anybody. So the parity throughout the league and the individual talent is in very, very good shape.
No, that's where I'm falling as well. I mean, I've sounded a little bit like old man yelling at cloud a few times, and there are always going to be things that I'm going to gripe about, like I miss this or I miss that about the way it used to be. But I find a lot of the players in the league really compelling to watch. You know, we could name players from Kawhi Leonard to Jalen Brunson. I mean, these are players I go out of my way to see. And that's pretty cool. And that's just two names. There are actually several players who, if I see that they're going to play that night, I'm like, oh, like I want to see what this brand. People seem to be high on this Brandon Miller kid. Like, I want to check out, you know, what he can actually do. And that's an exciting league. The positionless stuff I don't love. The bombing, the endless bombing from three-pointers sometimes leaves me high and dry. But if I had to say, yeah, 65-35, I'm into this league right now. And I do miss about 35% of the past. That's where I am.
Yeah, I mean, the another thing that's interesting and also pretty obvious, I'm sure it's talked about a lot in forums that that I don't listen to, is the fact that you take guys like Jokic and Embiid and Antetokounmpo. It's what we've talked about and kind of griped about positionless. And a lot of that, I think, is because of the players that we grew up loving so much, many of whom we've talked about on various episodes of this show, and are so connected to their position and to their competition at the position, that that's something that we hold dear. And the fact that that is no longer a familiar reference point or thought of conversation is something that I miss. But again, just going back to the players I just mentioned, it's what Jokic is doing at his size. It's what Embiid is doing at his size. It's what Giannis and Karl-Anthony Towns and now Wemby are doing at their size. We've talked recently about how triple doubles have gone from an incredibly impressive statistical and all-around game to almost ho-hum the norm for many players. But really, it's there's Luka, who, as I said, I think is the most skilled basketball player I've ever seen. But aside from him, the three guys who are nightly triple doubles are Jokic, Sabonis, and now Şengün in Houston is looking like that kind of guy. So it's just kind of fascinating that as every player can now handle and shoot, almost making the advantage of having a 7-footer under the basket, nullifying that and de-emphasizing that, the most skilled big men are actually finding ways to excel in ways that that guards really aren't. It was Westbrook and Harden shattering triple double records 5 years ago. It's the big guys now. So I don't really have a grand point on that. It's just very interesting as we have this statistical boom, much of it spurred by constantly putting 3 points on the board, adding to team scoring, individual scoring, and assists. A lot of those assists are on hitting 3-point shooters who are hitting the shots. But even through this, winding through this discussion, it's looking like it is the teams who have the big guys who have conquered this new way of playing ball are really kind of running the league. LeBron is still LeBron, as we've said, unprecedented and and just absolutely ridiculous who he still is. And I've said probably for 15 years, on a personal level, I don't know that I've ever seen a scorer like Kevin Durant. And anytime I watch the Suns, on any given possession, I'll still feel that way. Durant is still the most unguardable guy, but ultimately, Durant has never won a championship without Curry.
Well, that's
Steph's won without KD, but Durant has never, it has, having KD as your sole focal point, which his skills absolutely indicate that he is one of those very, very few guys. It actually has not been Durant standing at the very end. It's been Curry more recently, post KD, and Jokic, and we'll see who it is this year. Phoenix is very much in the mix, as much in the mix as anybody. But that to me is interesting. What amongst all the players with these not so games who are doing it every night, and 30 points a game used to win you a scoring title. Now, if you put up 30, that's probably good for like seventh in the league in scoring. But ultimately, who is going to be there at the end? And I have no idea. And it's going to be really cool to find out. And man, do I hope it's not Boston.
Wow. Speaking of great big men, right now I think I need to go see Nikola Jokic play against the Boston Celtics. Are you seeing that game?
I'm not going to stop you, man.
Let's see that game. No, we've hit the end of our times. This has been great, Arya. Really appreciate you. I think anybody listening to this will understand just exactly where the balance of forces are in today's NBA as an entertainment basketball product. So thank you so much, my brother.
Thank you for including me in this, man. It's been a lot of fun to talk and think about today's game amidst all of our various flashbacks. And I think it's a testament, again, to how many truly unique players there are in the league that that in talking for almost an hour, there's several really great players who we just didn't even get a chance to mention. And I think that that further supports that preferences can change, of course, but by and large, I think the league is in pretty solid shape.
Yeah, I agreed on that front for sure.
A champion is bred from hard times, scarred mind, standing on the ledge. The squad grind all time, victory in spite of opposition. Welcome to competition. Pick a side, I pick a side, they pick a side. Take a knee against abuse, they'd rather you die. Pushing through dark tunnels, trying to shed light. The fight is on, the moment we enter the game of life. Get it right before the whole thing gone dead. Let's go ahead and take it there. Meet me on the edge.
And now, some choice words. Okay, look, this is big news. The basketball team at Dartmouth has organized itself into a labor union after voting 13-2 to join SEIU Local 560. This is the men's team. Now, in the process, they are educating the seething NCAA that the future of university athlete relations lies in collective bargaining. Look, the current economy of college sports is, to put it mildly, discombobulated. An unregulated system where players can profit from their name, image, and likeness has upended the revenue-producing sports of football and basketball. The transfer portal that grants the freedom of so-called student-athletes to switch teams has also created a cultural sea change. In short, Shifting power is taking place away from autocratic coaches and athletic directors to the players themselves. And yet there still is that final frontier, unionization and collective bargaining, both of which could build a new and better framework for college sports. You see, here's the issue. While name, image, and likeness money benefits the famous few, and the transfer portal has been a vital reform, both skirt the question of whether these student athletes are in fact campus workers. As campus workers, they would, in theory at least, be free to organize into a union and demand collective bargaining, not just over compensation, but other issues that affect so-called student athletes, like medical care, travel demands, and the academic freedom to choose classes without athletic department interference. And this is just a smattering of the issues that would surely be brought to the table. Of course, the NCAA and many head coaches have no desire to sit across that table from the players. They decry unionization as an affront to everything good and holy about amateur sports. But the fortress of anti-unionism that is the NCAA has been breached by the Dartmouth players, and the sooner the NCAA recognizes that this breach cannot be closed, the better for all parties. Look, the NCAA has a choice. They can finally see the benefits of collective bargaining, or they can continue in their fierce belief that sham amateurism will have to be pried from their cold, dead hands. It certainly feels like they are going the latter route, but this is a battle for which the players are ready. Dartmouth teammates Cade Haskins and Romeo Myrtle told the Associated Press, "We stuck together all season and won this election. It is self-evident that we, as students, can also be both campus workers and union members. Dartmouth seems to be stuck in the past. It's time for the age of amateurism to end." Look, we need to cheer this victory, but we also need caution. It's not merely the NCAA standing athwart history and saying no to these athletes. Dartmouth University is making their objections very clear as well. According to SEIU, the administration told players that unionizing could get them booted from the NCAA or even from the Ivy League. Heaven forfend. Look, let's be clear. This is just fear-mongering, and we should remember that NCAA scare tactics about a lawless unionized future will indeed be a hurdle. But we would also do well to remember that the NCAA and their political lobbyists have been braying about progressive reforms killing college sports for at least 50 years. First, it was Title IX, the 1972 law providing women with equal access to, among other venues, athletic teams. That was what was going to kill college sports. Then it was players being able to opt out of scholarships after signing letters of intent. Then more recently, it was NIL and the transfer portal bringing godlessness to the land. Yet with each reform, the profits grow and the popularity increases, so much so that Iowa hoopster Caitlin Clark, the NCAA's biggest star since Tim Tebow, was tempted with a mammoth amount of NIL money to stay at Iowa University for a fifth year. Expect more of that. And expect the college game to actually be strengthened as a result, with players staying longer and fan interest growing. Now, while succumbing to collective bargaining would be in the NCAA's long-term interests, rather than flushing money on lobbyist luncheons and losing lawyers, they'll fight unionization until the bitter end. This is clearly not about money for them. It's about power. It's about anti-labor attitudes at the top of the sport and in Congress. Now, meanwhile, while the NCAA splinters, the players at Dartmouth are finding a new kind of community. Quevin O'Donnell, the national spokesperson for SEIU, described the following scene. He said, "At the last game, security workers, custodians, people who worked for the library were all cheering really loud because we consider the team part of Local 560 now. In the labor movement, we say siblings, sisters, and brothers. Those were our brothers playing ball. It was really nice to see these union members excited. There was a real sense of what the team had done and what the local had done and what the members have done." For Regis Sports, I'm Dave Zirin.
Thank you so much for watching The Real News Network, where we lift up the voices, stories, and struggles that you care about most. And we need your help to keep doing this work. So please, tap your screen now, subscribe, and donate to The Real News Network. Solidarity forever.
Yo, for everybody out there listening, thanks for all the feedback. Please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.